And joining us on the phone from down in St. Paul, from her home in St. Paul, is Mary Lethert-Wingard. Mary, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure to be here today.
Mary is the author of North Country, The Making of Minnesota. She's a professor of history at St. Cloud State University. And as I told our audience, listening audience earlier, Mary, I'm just thrilled to be finally doing this interview.
We did have a hard time getting scheduled, didn't
Well, I wish I could blame more of it on you. I can't. But as I mentioned earlier, you do have I think we owe you a postponement. So I'm going to give you that chance right now.
No, let's do it today,
let's
Bob.
Let's forge ahead. Let's forge ahead. First of all, I want to tell you, and without trying to... for any other reason than that it's really true, North Country, The Making of Minnesota is a wonderful book in so many ways. First of all, it was wonderfully written, and secondly, also beautifully laid out. I mean, this truly is a beautiful book, and I also want to give credit to, and now my glasses are failing me, Kirsten Delegard, who, if I'm not mistaken, did the layout for it.
Kirsten actually is a historian in her own right, and she assisted me with research, and she located all the images for the book.
And
the design of the book, of course, goes to the University of Minnesota Press, but Kirsten was just incredibly important.
Well, and the illustrations, the paintings, the photographs, the illustrations add, which they do, I guess, to any book, but add so much to this book and really complement your writing very much. It's a great book. It really, really is, and it's a beautiful book. There's obviously, you know, on any historical site's bookshelves, there are lots of histories of Minnesota. What's different about this one, and what was the genesis of this book, Mary?
Well, before I talk about what's different about it, I think I probably should tell you about how the book came into being. As you might recall, 2008 was the sesquicentennial of statehood for Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
And the University of Minnesota Foundation wanted to give a gift to the state on behalf of the university, and they decided that a new history of the state was long overdue, which it was, because the last scholarly study was done by Theodore Blegen and was published in 1962.
Mm.
And the trajectory of historical analysis has shifted so much in that time, away from only looking at important political figures and high politics, much more towards incorporating the people who really made history, the ordinary people. And not only just in terms of Minnesota history, but in social history in general, we see much more of an emphasis on people like you and me and the role that we played in making history.
Well, one out of two isn't bad.
Yeah. So they determined that this would be their gift to the University of Minnesota, and then the University of Minnesota Press contacted me and asked me if I would... if I would take this project on, and in a lapse of sanity, I said, oh, yeah, I probably could do that. But joking aside, after I got into the research, you know, I would say after about a year of working on research, I went back to the press and said, you know, you can't really write a seamless history of Minnesota that takes us from the period of first contact up to the present time, because there are two Minnesotas. And when I say there are two Minnesotas, I draw that line, well, probably pretty sharply in the 1860s.
Mm-hmm.
And if most of us think about it, most of what we know about Minnesota dates from around the Civil War forward. We know that story of immigrant settlement and development of the prairies and lumbering and so on and so forth, all the way up to, you know, our progressive politics and the growth of our economy and cultural institutions. But very few of us, and it really included me, I'm kind of embarrassed to say, even as a historian, that my knowledge of that early period was far more incomplete than it should have been.
Mm-hmm.
And what I saw is that earlier Minnesota that most people don't know anything about, in that time period, a whole different world existed here. One that was almost unimaginable today, a bicultural society where Native people and Europeans and then Euro-Americans found a way to live together in what was basically, for many years, a symbiotic manner where both of them got something from this relationship, mm-hmm. and that really changes quite sharply by the 1860s.
Yeah. Now, in your book, and while you spend a lot of time, which again is very different from previous histories that we read, but a lot of time talking about the native populations, the indigenous populations, most specifically the Ojibwe or Anishinaabe and Dakota. And yet you don't spend a lot of time in the book about just their population prior to the interaction with, at first blush, the French traders. Was that on purpose? Because you were taking what you did as kind of, okay, this is the snapshot we're going to look at?
Yes, that was intentional. I mean, it would have been, I just simply did not feel that I was qualified or that it was the story that I wanted to tell. And I believe in the introduction I say something along the lines that, you know, that the Native people have a rich history that's independent and precedes contact, but that's not really where this book focuses. What this book focuses on is that moment where these two cultures come together. And, you know, what scholars call this is a borderland culture. And it exists, we see it all over the place along frontier borders in North America, where you have a period of time where two different cultures come together, and until the power relations are established, they create an egalitarian sort of way of getting along that where ideas about race are not fixed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But almost everywhere, that period is very short. And one group, and in North America it's always been Europeans, then takes precedence and permanently subordinates people, you know, the people of the other group. And that's how we see race, as we think of race as being sort of firmly bounded. That's where we see it coming together. But what makes Minnesota different, and I think so important, is this borderland culture existed for 200 years.
Yeah.
We had generations of people who of mixed heritage.
I want to remind our listeners we're visiting with Mary Lethert Wingard, the author of North Country, The Making of Minnesota. It was put out last year by University of Minnesota Press. And that was one of the things that, you know, I think obviously as we have studied history in the past and learned history, we have been subjected to all sorts of myths and things that are not correct.
Mm-hmm.
And two of them that I thought were probably most glaring that I learned in your book. Number one, again, is this multiculture that existed for years of interrelationship, intermarriage, and so forth between primarily the Anishinaabe and French and then British traders, but also the fact, you know, I always heard historically that the Anishinaabe and the Dakota did not get along. They never mixed. They never got together. They were constantly at war. And that's really not true, is it?
No, that's not true at all. And in fact, there was a long period of time where they were allies. But even once they were, you know, and I would put this in air quotes, once they were at war, it was always much more locally defined. You never, Native people didn't go to war the way we think of going to war. It was a much more kind of sporadic, small-scale, local contest. So at one time, you might have two bands or two villages even of Dakota and Ojibwe, you know, fighting with each other. And not so very far away, you might find two other bands or two villages that were feasting together and intermarrying.
I'm reluctant to even talk about race because it is a little bit of a specious concept, but there was almost a race or a group of people. You refer to them as Métis, and that's and that name also has gotten to apply to a lot of people that it probably really shouldn't be applied to. That was, if I'm not mistaken, the culture that arose out of relationships and marriages between the French fur traders and the indigenous people, most specifically the Anishinaabeg. Talk a little bit about that culture, if you will, and the impact that it had on Minnesota.
Sure, I'd be happy to. And in fact, the term Métis does get applied rather broadly to all people of mixed ancestry. But as I define that term, and I think that the more narrow definition is maybe more useful, the people who were Métis, as you said, were descended from intermarriage between French and indigenous people, primarily Ojibwe, Ottawa, Cree, and people around where you are. this is one of the kind of strongholds of the birth of Métis culture. And what delineates Métis as different from simply people of mixed ancestry is that over time, they developed a distinct culture that wasn't entirely European and wasn't entirely Indian, and that had elements of both. And where you see this, there were settlements that were very identifiably Métis. Green Bay was one, at one time, Prairie du Chien. And the biggest one in our region probably was Pembina. And those people eventually, by the 1840s, in Pembina, had become a buffalo hunting society. And they had a very distinct culture that was different from other people of mixed ancestry. Many other people of mixed ancestry simply had the capacity to shift their identity as served them best at the time. They might, typically, a child might grow up in his mother's village, and then perhaps his father would send him to Montreal to be schooled. And he'd come back, and he might go back and live among his mother's people, or he might become a clerk and work as a fur trader.
Mm-hmm.
So Métis are quite distinct because they saw themselves as different from other groups of people. Now, after the 1860s, it wasn't possible to maintain that sort of unfixed identity. You were either white or you were Indian.
Yeah. We're visiting with Mary Lethert Winger, professor of history at St. Cloud State, about her book, North Country, The Making of Minnesota. When you talked earlier about, after saying, yeah, I can do this, perhaps questioning your sanity,
yeah.
Was it your intention originally to have this something that looked a little different? I mean, how did you finally get to this, and I can't think of any other word other than this snapshot of this part of the history of Minnesota, other than, of course, perhaps because it hasn't been dealt with before?
Well, I think, as you said, Native people are a big part of this book, but that's because they were a big part of making Minnesota. And I think that's one of the things that's really been missing. As I said, the original idea was to write a full survey of the state's history. But I went back to my editor and the head of the press at the University of Minnesota Press and said that's the wrong book. The book that we need to have written is of this earlier period. And part of what opened my eyes to this was some advice I got from Rhoda Gilman, who is a wonderful historian who was at the Minnesota Historical Society for many years and is the author of a really great biography of Henry Sibley. And I asked Rhoda, because she had been thinking about Minnesota history for many years, and I said, what advice would you give me? And she said, just think about how this story would be different if Indians were at the center of the story rather than an impediment.
Uh-huh.
And simply by taking that perspective, immediately everything looked different. It was a different vantage point.
Sure. One of the things that comes out of a book like yours or a history that's approached from that standpoint is that a lot of the people that we grew up learning about positively and about whom counties and cities and parks and so forth are named are perhaps not exactly who they were when we first learned about them.
Not perhaps as heroic as we think about. You know, the Minnesota Historical Society was established in 1849. That's the year Minnesota became a territory. And when you think about history is being written by the winners, clearly that was the case here.
You bet.
It was interesting because some of these figures who I had known about from grade school came to have, I came to think of them differently. Not always, you know, not always entirely evil. There are very few people who had no redeeming qualities. But as people who were struggling in a complex environment, my advisor in graduate school, who was a real mentor to me, used to say, you don't honor the people by romanticizing them. And I think that's so very true.
Yeah,
The people in the past were as complicated and contradictory as we are ourselves.
Hmm. In the few minutes that we have left, I read also someplace, and this isn't on the book, but that you are doing an oral history project at St. Cloud.
Yes,
can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I teach a graduate seminar in oral history, and as part of that seminar, we took on the project of locating people who were involved in the power line controversy of the 1970s. A far cry from what we have been talking about, but certainly a part of Minnesota history.
Uh-huh.
For those of us who are old enough to remember, that there was a widespread protest of farmers against the erection of high-voltage power lines across the western counties of the state of central Minnesota. And one of the things, and actually there was an oral history project that was done at the time, and what we were really interested in was going back to those people and asking them to reflect on their participation in that, what was ultimately an unsuccessful movement, and to see if participating in that affected them in their thinking about politics or their activism in later life. And so it's been very interesting talking to people, and we cast a wider net than the original oral history project did. So we've talked to people who were state troopers who were in a very difficult position, and business people, and we haven't nearly, you know, covered everything, but it's been a great experience for my students, and the interviews, if anyone is ever interested in using them for a research project, we have them archived at St. Cloud State.
Oh, great. We've been visiting with Mary Lethert-Wingert. She is a professor of history at St. Cloud State. She is the author, actually she's the author of a couple of books. Her first book was Claiming the City, Politics, Faith, and the Power of Place in St. Paul. Her most recent book, published last year by the University of Minnesota Press, North Country, The Making of Minnesota. Mary, once again, I want to not only thank you for being here, but let you know how very much I enjoyed the book. It really was wonderful, and I'm glad we could finally get together.
Well, I am too, and thank you so much for your kind words about the book and for inviting me to join the program.
Appreciate it. Take care, Mary.